This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Charlie Bennett from the Georgia Tech Library and host of Lost in the Stacks, sitting in for Steve Thomas. My guest today is Brian Matthews, who I worked with once, who is the Associate Dean for Learning at the Virginia Tech Libraries. So, Brian, throw yourself all the way back. How'd you get started in libraries?
You know, I think the thing that sort of drew me was, I think originally or initially, I really wanted to be a journalist. And in high school, I wrote for the paper, wrote a little bit in college. And, you know, what I kind of found is I really liked pulling the story together, the research, the data, primary sources, dealing with the world of information, if you will, bias, and that kind of thing. But during college, though, is when I realized that I just write too slow and too poorly, I guess, to kind of crank out what I needed to do as a journalist. And so during that time, I was working in a stacks department and putting books back on shelves. And, you know, that exposed me really to the core of libraries there, checking in books, putting them back, seeing what people are using and what's popular, and just sort of getting lost in the stacks, if you will, in that sense. And I had some younger librarians, 30-something librarians then, who were sort of mentoring me and kind of guided me into MLS program. So, you know, that's kind of how I got kind of hooked on it. I think this was all in the early, actually more of the mid-90s. So the web was really just emerging at that time, and journals were starting to dabble with electronic formats. And I remember we had a big, like, cake celebration around moving to, like, an online catalog from a Telnet-style catalog. So it was like, now there's a web catalog. You can search for books online, and that was kind of a big deal. And everyone was on AOL. It was just kind of a different time then. But so I just think that all those things kind of together of, you know, I'm fascinated with sort of the information streams, if you will, and putting that together, working in the stacks, getting good exposure to libraries, and then this whole idea of how libraries were sort of priming or getting ready there for all that change that happened over the last 20 years or so.
And so you didn't even know that newspapers were going to die.
I mean, I have college newspaper right here in my hand. Still clinging to that, but.
And how did, so how did you go?
They morphed it. We'll say news is morphed.
News is morphed. How did you go from getting your MLS to, you know, tell me if this is apocryphal or not, right? Or being the very first user experience librarian in North America.
Yeah. So after the MLS, I had a good benefit where I was working as a staff member at Central Florida Libraries and circulation and reference, and so I had a really good foundation in public services and while doing the degree. And I went to Washington, D.C. I think the journalist in me was hungry for that a little bit. So I worked at George Washington University for about 3 years, and which is literally like two blocks from the White House. So it was kind of like you're out eating lunch and you've got journalists and politicians and lobbyists, and, you know, it's the perfect place for that. So I was in D.C. and kind of working through, you know, the basics of learning reference, learning, you know, all the core, becoming a librarian, if you will. And that was cool, but I was really enticed by Georgia Tech with the start of the Commons. And at that point, it was like the West Commons. I'm all mixed up on your guys' side.
The West Commons was the first one, yeah.
Yeah, the first one was had just been finished, and, you know, it was just like, we've got 100 pieces of software, we've got all this. It was just it was an exciting sort of time. It was really one of the, I think, early exciting commons like that was coming online. So that I was really drawn to that. And I guess with user experience, I think I officially took that title in like August 2007 or something like that. I've been doing some of that stuff before, but that was when that fall semester it kind of became official. And for me, it kind of became a conglomerate of, or this intersection of, like, marketing and assessment and providing services intermingled with, like, library website design and physical space design and interaction. And, you know, digging into some data like the transactions that are happening, who's coming in the library, what they're doing, that kind of thing, but also sort of the live qual and satisfaction stuff. And, you know, ethnography at that time was really kind of just emerging in sort of libraries. So it kind of all kind of came together there. I think the thing I was really interested in is sort of that student journey or that learning journey that happens. Not just I come in the library and then I do some homework and then I leave, but how does that journey happen over the semester, over the years, and how do they maybe find out about new services or try new things, or how does coming in the morning different than at night, and that kind of thing. So really just trying to understand that bit a bit.
So if we had to define what the experience was that a user experience librarian was concerned with, it was the user's experience of their life and the library's place in it, not their experience of the website or their experience of the stacks or anything like that.
No, I think that's kind of well said. I mean, I think a little bit of the way I would try to frame it, you know, at that time and even I guess now, is to think about it like airlines, where, you know, I can I can plan a trip to go to San Francisco or Chicago or New York, doesn't matter where, but I'll go online, look for a ticket, find a flight, select my seat, pay for it, you know, all that. And, you know, the experience though is more than just going online and getting that ticket. It's like I have to show up at the airport, I have to park, I have to get through baggage and security, find my gate, deal with the delay, connect to the wireless, you know, and then I'm on the plane, and what's that experience like when I'm there? And then I land and I have to get to my hotel. So it's it's really that whole journey. And I kind of figured if I worked for Delta or Southwest or whoever as a user experience professional or something like that's what I have to look at, is that whole journey and sort of what policies and workflows, what can we control, what can't we control, and be conscious of that. And when situations happen, like, okay, your flight's delayed or your flight's canceled, you know, kind of what protocol, what happens then? And it's less about just, okay, the person is going to Chicago and that's it, but how am I building every trip that you kind of take is part of that relationship, is kind of a trendy word, but that ongoing service that I'm having with that individual or so on. So that's how I try to think about it, like that, where I think one of the, what I see UX today, I don't know if that's your next question or something like that, it's a little bit of, you know, I see it in different flavors, I guess. There's a lot of UX librarians or variations of that, user engagement you see sometimes, but you know, I think it's like sometimes I'll see it in like an IT office, and it's really around the web experience and how do we make our resources seamless and a good usability and this kind of thing. Sometimes I'll see it in more of a public service thing where it's like events and marketing and, you know, engagement and those kind of things. And then sometimes it's in like an admin office, and it's more like planning and assessment and strategic this and that. So I think it has to be kind of all those things, you know, and that way you kind of loses its punch or loses its effectiveness when it's just, we're about the web usability, we're about space usability, we're about documentation or whatever. So
now, why did you dismiss it as strategic this and that?
Well, for some reason I want to say something like accreditation, or like I was trying to think through, there's kind of like, there's the strategic planning you do you know, as a library, but then there's also the, what's the strategy that the your university or college is kind of doing? What's the strategy that, you know, the College of Liberal Arts is doing? So it's really kind of linking more than just the library strategic plan, but more of the strategy that we're using to deploy people. Well,
so right now, user experience as a UX, as a discipline in libraries, is a no-brainer. I don't think anybody would argue that you shouldn't focus on that in some way. But at the time when you were doing it at Georgia Tech, was there resistance? Did it seem like the library was a good fit for user experience studies, or how did that go for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, the folks at GT were pretty receptive. I think a little bit of it was unclear of like, okay, what are we kind of doing? And I remember getting a lot of like emails and phone calls from other sort of administrator types or people from other libraries who were kind of like, we want to kind of go in this direction. Is this just a web person, or is this assessment? You know, there wasn't a very clear standard, I guess, of what is sort of the UX. I think, you know, a lot of the one thing that's helped it, I think, has been I guess, the ethnography movement, or a lot of sort of, let's study how people are sort of doing, how they're doing it. And, you know, I think the kind of blossomed on, at Rochester, and some other places have kind of taken that on as well. It's much more common now to have sort of, you know, anthropological techniques in there. But it gets us closer to that understanding of the journey. I think sometimes maybe we focus the journey involving the library too much rather than what's happening outside of the library that people are experiencing and so on. But for me, you know, I don't think I came across like resistance. It was more of like uncertainty of, you know, that seems kind of interesting. What is it? How do you scale it? How do you work with people? So it was more of that type of questions.
And that was right when the library, I think 2002, the library opened essentially a giant computer lab.
Yeah.
And that was the one big change. That was the commons you talked about. And that was before it was a library commons or learning commons or the undergraduate learning commons or anything like that. So it really was just this, okay, we're changing pretty radically, but no one was even touching the books yet. So is there a straight line between user experience librarian and associate dean of learning? And I know that you went to California and came back to the coast. So I don't mean your travels, but I mean in the way the job is, how your skills developed.
Yeah, I think, you know, another thing I find myself talking a lot about is I have to kind of think horizontally, or think instead of vertically, where it's just, okay, this is the reference department and this is what they do, or this is circulation, or this is cataloging. And it's more of, again, when you think about that journey that a student or faculty has, and they're kind of like, I need a space to work, but then sometimes I need resources, and then I'm working on this research project. And so I think it's been helpful for me to try to one of the benefits I had at sort of leaving Georgia Tech and going out to California was I kind of reported to the dean there, and it was kind of this big projects kind of role. So it was a lot of like, okay, we got to renovate. We had this capital project, $70 million or whatever, that was kind of new additions or renovations, some seismic stuff. So being a part of that team and bringing students in, bringing people together, it's kind of leading that charge. But also, it was kind of like, we're redesigning our whole website. We're moving everything to Drupal from static HTML. So it was, again, that was a charge I had where I wasn't doing the work, if you will. I'm not coding, I'm not designing, I'm not writing. But it's kind of facilitating all these different departments, all these different folks, and bringing that together and then producing something and that kind of thing. So I kind of feel like the UX gave me that sort of perspective of not to just think of like one department and here's our mission and here's what we do, we're going to do it really well, but starting to think of what's the library trying to do as sort of a collective, if you will, and starting to interact with people outside the library. So I worked, I think, at GT and as well as out in California, I worked a lot with sort of student affairs and starting to learn their kind of world, campus IT, provost office, those kind of things. So, I mean, in terms of that, I think that's what the UX kind of conditioned me for, maybe, was how am I bringing people together to advance their projects a little bit or their interests and working sort of outside of the library a bit.
And what was the actual title of the California job?
I don't remember this stuff.
What would you call it now, if looking back at it?
I thought it was something like I had to look at my information. We can add that later. But it was kind of like they didn't use the dean model out there. They used like university librarians. I was like an assistant university librarian for like an academic engagement, something like that. I'll have to dig that up.
So in your professional life, everything's basically been a canvas for you to play with, right? There's not specific jobs. Would you have been able to do anything else, you think, or were you always going to be geared toward just this exploratory kind of making it up as you go along kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I really, you know, with this idea of the exploratory and that kind of thing, I really think that the thing that unleashed that for me was, I think, you know, working with Crit Stewart. You know, I think like his, you know, not directly telling me like go forth and explore, but he would always kind of take like, here's this thing I'm interested in, and he would kind of find a way to sort of like, well, here's a little bit of money if you want to kind of start, see where that can go, or just give me sort of encouragement, or not getting in my way, I guess, to do that. But so I think that kind of turned something for me there, where it was like, I can kind of do this at a larger level and so on. But even early on, I mean, I remember I was a staff member in the library at UCF, Central Florida, where I did my undergrad. And at that time, this is again, like, I don't know, 96 or so, around that time, like, we were one of the earlier libraries that were exploring, like, chat reference. You know what I mean? It was before, it was like, you're using, like, AOL, Instant Messenger, and things like that, where it's, so I kind of had a boss who was, you know, would humor my interest of, like, what if we tried this? What if we tried this kind of thing? He's like, okay, set it up, run with it, let's see where it goes. So I think it's just a little bit of my personality is sort of exploratory, you know, with that. And I've just been lucky to have some bosses that sort of encouraged that and maybe nurtured that. And so now I try to remind myself to be that person too. And I think that's one of the big things I find with administration is it's less about what I kind of want to do, and it's more about encouraging people to come up with ideas and pitch them and then fund them and give them time to do that. So I think that's a transition I'm maybe still going through a little bit too after all this time is there's certain projects that I really kind of get into that I want to do. And maybe kind of getting into administration was so I could do that in a larger scale or have a larger impact, I think.
So you're able to be that kind of boss to your people?
I try to be that kind of boss to my people, yeah.
Mm. How many folks report to you directly?
Directly? That's a good question. I have 40 people in my unit, and I probably have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. I have 5 direct reports.
So does that make it easier or harder to give people freedom?
Yeah, it goes both ways. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, you try to encourage your managers to be, you know, open in that way, but sometimes you need to have kind of a process with that, where there's a lot of there's sort of the day-to-day work that needs to get done, like at our circulation desk or our reference desk or facilities and that kind of thing. But one of the things we try to do is really build into people's, we make it into their job descriptions and everything out there, where there's like a 5%, 10% of their time is like looking for ways to improve what we do, whether that's a workflow or that's a, you know, I'm kind of noticing students are dragging chairs over here and maybe we should explore that or something like that, where you're just kind of, your radar's kind of always up for looking like, how can we kind of improve something? And I've had, like, one example I had is someone from CERC kind of emailed me and we got these new chairs for these computers and they're nice and everything. And he's kind of like, I'm a little worried because they have wheels on them and there's no carpet here and I'm afraid someone's going to fall or something like that. So I was able to tell him, thanks for recognizing that. You know, are there any other chairs you think we should, can we swap them out somewhere else? And he's like, yeah, I think we can do it. So sometimes it's, I think when you're in a culture where it's very hierarchical and that's what people are used to, of like, you tell me what my job is and I'll do it and that's it. It's kind of hard to break that a little bit. So it's less about maybe who I am or my managers or what we're trying to do, but it's kind of trying to encourage that sort of perspective, I guess, of, you know, kind of always looking out and seeing what's going on, or, you know, here's this kind of technology, maybe we should kind of dabble with that. And, you know, that's something we've done with 3D printing. I know you have a lot of thoughts on 3D printing, but
I have personally thoughts about 3D printing, right, that we should not get into on this.
I'm just going to say this before we even, you know, we bought a very, like, cheap model and, you know, I let my team, like, play with it for a year before we even talked about, do we want to do a service? You know, do we want to make it available? You know, and there's a lot of hype in libraries about that, and that is what it is. But it was, you know, what we try to do is if I can, you know, buy something really inexpensively and let my folks play with it, then we do that. Like, for example, we bought a drone too, and I really want to circulate drones and we're kind of by the book here in certain ways because there's a lot of drone research that our campus does, and there's a airport right next to us, and there's all kinds of weird stuff, like the FAA doesn't want you to, like, what I'm being told is we can't legally check out drones to people, but someone could buy their own drone and sell and use it on campus and they'd be their own thing. You know, it's a hobbyist thing, but we can't. So I have guys that are using it and they're kind of like, you know, developing those skills. And then eventually we hope to have some sort of drone program and so on. But we're even like teaching faculty about it, teaching people, you know, we just can't check it out to you to go take and fly outside on, you know, in our spaces. So that's the approach I think I try to take is like, can we just sort of, you know, if there's certain technology that's sort of trendy or has potential, let's buy it and let us use it and dabble with it and learn about it and then see if it does it roll out into to a service or not. So that's a little bit of, I think, as an administrator, I can kind of enable those things to happen.
Well, let's take a trip down the 3D printer thing real quick. Because I actually have come around a bit.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So what were the things that were happening in that year? Let me orient the listener very quickly. I'm very against 3D printers in academic libraries. I was for a while. And then someone came up and said, you can give social scientists a chance to do very interesting visualizations of their data with 3D printers. And I said, okay, you know what? That just opened it up for me. Now I'm willing to hear more and to experiment more. So how did you use that year to experiment with a piece of technology?
Sure. So I think, you know, with our 3D printing story was, you know, on our campus, there's many 3D printers of different types, but what we kind of find, some of them are high quality, really expensive, some of them are, you know, decent quality, but the thing you run into is they're usually associated with a major or a class. Like engineering has its things. Education department, which we kind of focus on a lot of, probably like you guys at Georgia Tech, but a lot of like technology education or engineering education or that kind of a thing, science education, that kind of thing. So there's some over there, and you know the business folks have theirs. But so yeah, every architecture has theirs. You know, there's different labs depending on who you are, and there's different funding models. Everything's cost something there. So our approach that we try to do is there's some folks, like you kind of mentioned, some of the social sciences and humanities, and even business in some degree, who don't have access to these things. We kind of wanted to have a very small lab with like 10 different machines. We wanted to have of different ranges of quality, meaning entry level to high end, kind of not too high end, but higher end kind of thing. And what we kind of were interested in two things. One, we didn't want it to just be we kind of came upon, I'll tell more of the backstory too, but we didn't want it to just be you drop off your file or send us your file and then come pick it up. You know, we really wanted it to be like you're learning about prototyping, you're learning about sort of design, you're learning about the, you know, whatever it is. You can kind of set it up and print it and then leave. But we wanted to really make it a very sort of hands-on type of lab that's like that. And the second thing we wanted to do is we wanted to make it free. And so we're able to buy a ton of a filament and some other supplies through some private funds, but also through a nice chunk of money we got from our provost and others. So we have probably about 18 months of sort of free service that we're kind of doing. And then we also kind of linked it a little bit to sort of a land grant mission where we can, on certain days, we kind of open up to the community where we can get like K-12 kids kind of coming in, and there's certain programs for them. We kind of want to partner with our public library kind of on that. And then, you know, just others as well. There are certain days when alumni are coming in for football games and whatnot. Like there's things that we can do to kind of make it beyond just sort of our students. And so what we kind of found is there's a lot of, not a lot, but there's a number of classes where students are producing things. I know you guys do this at Georgia Tech too, where you write a paper, but you also create an infographic or a web component and, you know, make some type of artifact or a prototype or something like that. Even in like technical writing, we kind of found a class where they use like cardboard and have to build like a little prototype of whatever it is, some kind of device or something like that. And so there just seem to be different components like that where it's really more about prototyping and sort of designing rather than specifically about 3D printing. We see 3D printing as a form of that. We even had a creative writing professor who liked this assignment of you write a paragraph describing an object and make it kind of vague, and then you have to give that paragraph to somebody else, and they have to 3D print whatever it is you're describing, and then there's like an unveiling then where it's kind of like you wrote yours, and I'm in class, I'm kind of showing, here's what I read about your thing, and is this what it is? What the hell is this? Kind of a thing. So that's what we've kind of seen, is there's different ways we can kind of work with faculty to make it about multimodal learning, if you will, or that kind of thing. So it's not just about the research, which we kind of feel those research capabilities are probably elsewhere. You know, we're just trying to get people excited about design and thinking about, you know, how do they sort of express, you know, whatever they kind of want to express. So that's what we kind of are treating it almost as a literacy of sort of learning to prototype, learning to sort of make something, if you will, and then, you know, having that as their toolkit.
So the level of detail that you just went into about,
like, sorry about that.
No. This is good. I mean, it's good for that. to hear of all that, but then also the level of detail that you went into this project, like that you knew. I'm looking at what you're responsible for in the learning division. You've got these five big groupings, these big silos: learning services, learning commons, project studios, facilities, international outreach. And just one of those, learning commons, has ref desk, circ desk, reserves, textbooks, tech lending, book runners, student team, commons events, course exhibits, video wall, 3D design lab, printing and photocopy, security and housekeeping.
Yes.
How are you able to be that detailed about a project when you have all this other stuff? How do you, how do you administrate and still maintain kind of the level of interest that you just described to me through the 3D printing?
She's saying, like, how does my wife put up with me being away all the time and that,
you know,
kind of thing?
If you'd like to answer that, that'd probably be good for some folks too. Yeah.
No, I think, you know, each of those sort of areas, like, so with learning commons, you know, I have a sort of a director of that commons, and so he oversees, and there's each of those kind of areas. So when you look at like the ref desk and circ desk, reserves, all that, there's kind of like a manager for that, and that person reports to the head of my learning commons. In the group with like my student team, which is kind of like a student rovers, I guess the way to describe that, and the different events and those kind of things, there's sort of a manager that handles those things, and she reports to the learning commons director. So it's we just have these different sort of levels of managers that can make things happen. With the 3D printing lab, I mean, with us, it's a lot of student labor, and there's sort of a team of four people who are really kind of excited about that type of thing, and they're kind of like a council, I guess, and they kind of make some decisions, they kind of run with it. So my thing is really, I kind of framed, I want it to be free, I want it to be connected to learning, and I wanted it to at least have some entry-level printers that people could use. So I kind of, like, am the editor, I guess, or I kind of set a, here's the sort of flavor, or here's the kind of intention, you know, and then asking them to sort of fill in the details or find some things that are missing and articulate that. So sort of that group handles the scheduling of it, the hiring of it. The students that kind of work there, they manage the budget of it, they do the PR of it. So it's, I'm not directly involved in a lot of that stuff. I just hype up what the stuff that they're doing when I talk about it on campus. And so my job, I really see, is to kind of create a tone and then find money. It's kind of, yeah. How do I keep it free? How do I keep it going? How do I,
And is there, are these five groupings, are they very different and you have to kind of change gears to work on each of them? Or do you feel like they're all...
No, they're all extremely different. I mean, you know, our learning services team is really sort of, that's our instruction team, and they kind of go out and engage with the classes. And so that's, you know, that's a particular service that we're doing, that most of it is happening sort of in the classroom or in our classrooms. We're bringing people in. So that's that kind of a thing. With Commons, it's really more of, you know, it's a lot of students using our building and kind of doing different things. So whether that's we're dealing with housekeeping and keeping the building clean to, you know, what's happening at the ref desk, what's happening at the circ desk, and that kind of thing. Those two are kind of our largest in terms of number of people. If I had to guess, I'd say it's probably 80% of our people work in those, of my division, 80% of the folks work in one of those two units. And then the others are much smaller. I mean, facilities has, you know, a handful of people in there, but they're a little bit more, you know, dealing with certain processes. Like, we have to make sure things are safe and this kind of thing. But they're also dealing with, like, the emergent, you know, there's a leak. There's a, you know, power outage. There's a renovation that's happening, this kind of thing. So a lot of their jobs are sort of responding to crises and that kind of thing. So it's really the two, my main two areas is where I kind of have to focus probably the majority of my time.
Do you still feel like a librarian?
No, I don't.
Yeah. Is what survived in this long process of originally being a librarian?
You know, sometimes I feel like I'm more of like, it varies on different days. It depends what I'm doing. But like, sometimes I feel more like I work for like student affairs and how they're kind of, you know, trying to enrich the student experience and that kind of thing. Sometimes it's like I'm in the provost office where it's looking at how are we looking at spaces across the campus and doing things. And once in a while, not as much, but kind of campus IT a little bit, where I kind of feel like we're looking at these technical problems and so on. But so What's your question?
So clearly the first part is, no, I don't really feel like a librarian so much anymore. Is there a part of being a librarian that has stayed? Is there anything that you still feel like, yeah, this was how I was a librarian when I started, and I am still that way now?
I mean, I think we talked on it a little bit earlier, but it was that sort of that exploratory, experimental kind of thing. And, you know, I think for me, you know, when I get excited is like when a faculty member comes into my office or to our team and they're like, you know, I want to try to teach differently. You know, this kind of way I'm doing isn't working. I want to kind of brainstorm with you guys about how can I bring in some different resources? How can I teach it in a very flexible room? How can I bring in some technology? I want to get them blogging. You know, so when I think when faculty come to us and are kind of like, you know, we see these things that you guys are doing and encouraging, you know, I want to use your 3D printing lab, these kind of things, that's where I kind of get excited, where it's like we're enabling people to do something that they wouldn't be able to do otherwise. So they're really reflecting on how can I do what I'm doing, you know, differently, hopefully better as well. And I see that with students as well, where, you know, there's sometimes it's as easy as they're working on a paper or a project or something like that, and they're coming to us because they're stuck or something like that. But beyond just the sort of assignment, sometimes we have students that will come in and they're like, you know, I really want to do some type of an event, or I want to host something, or I want to, you know, I had one guy who like wanted to, like, there was a class that didn't exist and he thought it should exist. It was sort of a design thinking class, and he was like, saw some of my writings and scheduled an appointment, and he's like, it's this important class that we should have. I think everyone should have an elective in the, and so he's kind of coming to me and kind of saying, like, could I help him, you know, could I advocate for him, but could I also help him figure out, like, well, what would the assignments look like? What are the sort of information tools for this? And so it's kind of like that kind of thing happens more often than maybe you'd think it would do. I don't know, maybe once or twice a month, you know, it depends on the flow of the semester, but I'll get those kind of things from students where they want to try to do something. They want to kind of shake something up. They want to, you know, whatever. Sometimes startup kids will come in and so on. So that's the thing for me, is like, that's where I kind of feel the librarian part of me comes in, because my very first job at George Washington, you know, I spent a lot of time as like a patents librarian. So a lot of times people would, particularly faculty, would be doing patent searches and this kind of thing. And so it kind of feels like that a little bit, where I have this idea, I don't know what I need to do next. Whether that's I'm changing the curriculum, I'm changing how I teach, I'm creating a company, I want to put together some kind of run on campus or something like that. So I think not just about me, but being able to frame the library as that type of resource, I guess, where it's, you know, we're invested and interested in the community and how do we help that type of thing happen. But we're not student affairs, which sometimes maybe our student affairs are great, but they have certain rules they have to follow. So for us, it's kind of like we're kind of informally just talking here. There's nothing serious. I'm just trying to get some advice on this kind of thing. So that spirit of it, of kind of like the reference desk a little bit, where I need to write this paper on cloning and I don't know where to, I'm stuck, where do I go next, that kind of thing, translating to or manifesting itself in sort of other outputs maybe, still gets me excited.
And is that what drives you to write the books and the papers and make the presentations, where you're sort of basically just revealing all of your secrets?
That's the journalist in me that's kind of... doesn't want to quite give up on that. I don't know. I mean, I think it's you know, a lot of times I think pretty much more like the books and some of the papers are, I kind of think of it more as like art for me. I don't know if that sounds corny or something, but for me it's really about that sort of expression. And like, I can't even remember, like, I just wrote a book and I sent you the rough draft of it, but
yeah,
I can't even remember half of what's in there. It's like I get in this sort of trance mode when I'm writing that's not me. It's like an alter ego or something, I don't know. And it's just sort of like I'll spend a lot of time reading and thinking and reflecting on, you know, what I've been doing, and then I kind of assemble that into some sort of narrative. And it's the closest thing I could do is that, you know, I try to treat it as sort of art rather than scholarship.
Is that why you're going to do the sort of more expressionistic layout of the new book?
Yeah, I think with this one, I mean, very early on, you know, I when the idea was still kind of coming together, I kind of hired a interior design student. I think she was like a sophomore. Now she's a senior, so I've been working on it for a while. To kind of really, I really want it to be married together. Like, the design and the sort of text are, you know, comb- mind, then it's not just like, here's a flexible environment and here's what it would look like. It was more than that. But even like the way it's designed, the way it kind of looks, the way we frame the text and all that, I just kind of really wanted it to be different than a sort of a scholarly book or a regular book where it kind of challenges you to look different. And I've done that with some of my papers too, where I've put some papers, you know, they're in like an Elsevier journal or some other journals. And I always do a preprint, and I always have hired a graphic designer to kind of do some different layouts there, because my feeling was a preprint could just be a Word document version of your article or something like that. But I kind of wanted to challenge that a little bit and say, what if I can make the preprint more interesting than the actual article and make it more valuable or more stylistic or something like that? And so I've kind of done that. I've never gotten in trouble about that yet, but you know, I just kind of want to be able to kind of say, this is how I see this, you know, these ideas. I always wanted to put, you'd appreciate this, I always wanted to put like a soundtrack together. So it's like, if you're reading this book or this article or something like that, listen to these three songs.
Oh, I've always wanted to do that. Yeah.
Maybe I'll do that with the book.
It seems so invasive.
I really wanted
though.
To do that because there's certain moods I have that I'm like, you know, I'll listen to like a song and then I'm kind of like, you know, this is how that book feels to me or whatever. So yeah, I kind of see it as, you know, in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, you know, the stuff I've been putting out is more like that. It's more of a artistic expression about sort of libraries or processes rather than like a blueprint or anything like that.
And the books are called Encoding Spaces. Are you going to stick with that title?
Right now, I mean, I'm getting my edits back from on Tuesday, next 7 days. So I'll see what the publisher and editor recommend, but right now it's Encoding Spaces. It's been Encoding Spaces for the last year, so I'm kind of stuck there.
And when will people be able to see that?
I don't know. I'm hoping it's going to be out in February. You know, we're kind of doing all the design. You know,
no
the
one will hold you to this. This is a teaser.
February 28th, it'll be out. You know, we worked out a deal with sort of, it's being published by ACRL, and I think about 60% of it we're going to put out for free in PDF. You know, as soon as we're able to, you know, when that's out there. So, you know, we're going to kind of go through and, you know, I think we can post up to 60% of it. So we'll kind of get some of the core things that we really wanted to express. We'll get that out there.
So how do you feel about the focus coming off of books in libraries, in the actual physical paper book?
Yeah. You know, it's hard. It's tough for me because again, that's, you know, what attracted me to libraries was, again, working in stacks, dealing with those books, and even microfilm a little bit, where I was kind of like, it's such a complicated system. I was like so obsessed with like being able to use it and find what you want and that kind of thing. And I got into like GovDocs and these complex systems of information, really kind of interesting to me. But, you know, I think libraries like Georgia Tech and Virginia Tech are really kind of different maybe than other places. I think when we have a very heavy percentage of our students and faculty are in the sciences and engineering. For me, you know, what I have been trying to kind of always say is like, you know, we will see less print materials in our building, but it's the focus is really about how people use and share sort of information is how I keep kind of talking about that. So it's less about that physical artifact and more about the what are we doing with it? What are we kind of producing? And I think a thing that we've been trying to do, I imagine, you know, Georgia Tech as well, is how can we really get a really good sort of delivery system? So that way it's kind of increasingly, you know, we're seeing more faculty are requesting delivery of our books through campus mail or whatever. So it's kind of, you know, what does that look like? And how can we speed that up even more? So it becomes, you tell us what you want, we'll get it for you. It doesn't matter if we have it in the collection or not. That's not the question. It's just tell us what you need or whatever you need, we'll get for you. But I think, you know, what I'm kind of seeing more and more, particularly in my library, is we'll probably become a humanities and social science, more humanities and light amount of social sciences in terms of our print collection. So kind of your art and art books and those kind of things. So what is your core, like, working collection that needs to be in physical formats in your building? And I kind of see it's, you know, we'll see how it changes in terms of you know, disciplines. You know, what I'm kind of seeing, like, even in the English, you know, there's some people that, you know, really are attached to that print book and it's very sort of important to them. And then others who are like, yeah, I like having the print book, but it's great having the digital too, because now I can do certain searches and I can mine text and do all these other kind of new research questions that have emerged. So I kind of feel we're going to be in a period of sort of transition there, whereas, you know, our engineers and science are all about, you know, just get us digital packages, just get it to us so we can use it in labs and everywhere we are. So it's kind of hard to say, you know, the one size fits all. I think it's going to be, it's going to evolve over the next 2 decades here.
Are there any trends or I'll just say fads to be dismissive that you really don't dig at all right now in libraries?
I don't. You want me to like talk bad about somebody or something here?
Is that what you think it would be though? I mean, I
don't know.
If it's that, then I don't want you to do that. But I mean, there seem to be movements within library science and library operations, and you can kind of tell. Like if I ask myself what's different than 5 years ago, you know, there's things that people aren't talking about anymore. And I mean, information commons to learning commons to library commons, or library commons to learning commons. That was a pretty easy trend. And, you know, but then there's other stuff. I feel like people must be thinking this about us, Georgia Tech, maybe even me in particular, because I try to be very vocal about it. It's like the books aren't the only thing. And some people say the books are the only thing. You're crazy. So,
really?
Yeah, totally.
I don't run into that. I don't know. I feel like I've pulled away a lot from libraries, and you know, I actually, you know, I dropped out of ALA and I joined the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and it's like $50. It's like so affordable. But I'm just, you know, like a lot of the stuff I'm basing a lot of our space on right now, like our physical space, is like I'm getting that off of like NASA and like looking at how they look at like their space, like outer space policy, and what they're kind of doing and trying to get to Mars, and there's all these different steps they have to do to get that. And so we have certain objectives that we want to do outside of the library, like different relationships with living, like a presence in a living learning community, a presence in a new classroom building, a presence in a research building, a presence in, you know, an innovation building. So it's less about how do we take our physical library as it is and make it the best we can. I mean, that's always going to be, we're going to always be working on that. But now it's like, how can we develop this presence, whatever that is, a relationship, a physical space, a, you know, whatever, in these other places? How are we packaging the library to exist in a living learning community? And what would that sort of library-themed community sort of look like? What kind of assignments might they do? What kind of interactions would they do? How do we showcase knowledge? And the same thing in like a research building. Like, how are we bringing these researchers together? How are we helping them get grants? How are we helping them get tenure? That's a different slant kind of there. And same thing with a classroom building. How are we sort of getting classes that maybe normally wouldn't interact, like a psychology and econ, and making it so like that sometimes during the semester they do interact, where maybe they co-teach each other, or they compete against each other, or they collaborate together on a project or something, or all three of those things over the course of a semester. And that's the thing that I think we're able to, by freeing ourselves up of, we can only do things that happen in the library, but looking at how can we do stuff, library stuff, in other buildings and have a presence, whatever that is. So all that's coming to me from NASA right now and how I'm approaching that. So for me, it's kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say I've kind of been ignoring or I've been sort of turning away a little bit from like a lot of library conversations. So I kind of am out of the loop a lot of what's happening in terms of trends and fads and those kind of things.
That was the most well-constructed deflection I've ever heard. It was fantastic. So if someone's listening to this and they feel like where you're at is where they want to go, do you have any advice for them?
I mean, I always encourage, and I have encouraged for a while, to read outside the profession and to go to things other than ALA, you know, look at something like, you know, like healthcare, and how are they sort of dealing with like a move to a digital world? How are they sort of sharing information? How are they not sharing information? What's their user experience or customer or client or patient experience, whatever? What's that journey look like? You know, what are we getting in, you know, as we move into like personalized medicine? Maybe reflect on that as like a personalized library. You know, I've actually had a faculty member kind of say that in the humanities, where they're like, you know, when we come in here, I mean, when a scientist comes in, you know, they get $1 million to buy a telescope that they need, or microscope or whatever they kind of need. Well, there's certain things I need from a collection that maybe me and two other people sort of want, but we can't buy it because the whole subscription for the whole community, the whole campus is too much. So I think that's a trend, if you will, or a thing to kind of think about, is like what are personalized sort of libraries, if you will, kind of look like. And that's another topic another day. They're kind of there. But back to this health thing, you know, again, what are the benefits to whatever they're kind of, how healthcare is kind of changing? What are the sort of ethics involved? You know, how are hospitals reorganizing? How are hospitals changing their physical environment, like waiting rooms and this kind of thing? And what's the science behind that? So, you know, I think there's just, you know, whether it's health or retail or business or how are these other folks going through the disruptive change that we're kind of seeing as ourselves, you know, as higher ed is sort of changing, as publishers are changing, and our commons areas, our physical spaces are changing, curriculum is changing, research is becoming more open, and that kind of thing. All this kind of stuff is what can we learn from looking at someone else and using those sort of case studies coming in there. So, again, I just really encourage people to, you know, particularly if they want to get into kind of the stuff that I'm doing, is kind of, you know, find those sort of metaphors and find those sort of examples and case studies from other places to kind of change. Because I think sometimes if you talk about, oh, okay, we're going to make a change here and it's going to be like this, and it's different if I can say, you know, when you look at Lego was at this point where they were on the brink of bankruptcy. And one of the problems was they didn't know, they had all these different departments, but at the end of the year, end of the whatever, they kind of just knew we're losing money. They didn't know, like, are certain departments performing well, certain departments not. I guess Harry Potter's a big success, but some other things aren't. So how do they kind of had to really realign what they're doing, getting back to their core and getting into more of, like, sharing and that kind of a thing. And one of the big problems they kind of found was, like, they're making, I don't know the exact number, but let's just say they made, like, 20,000 unique pieces, unique bricks and this kind of a thing. And it was, like, some of those unique pieces only worked for, like, one set, you know, and the original whatever of Lego was that intermixing, that you know, everything could go together with everything else, and you can build different things. So they cut things down to like 8,000 pieces that they made, and they kind of found different ways to be creative sort of with those kind of things. So again, when you kind of start a story of looking at sort of like, here's what Lego did, here's how they sort of did this and came out, you know, successfully in that, now let's reflect on that and then think about our sort of restructuring and stuff. What do we know? What don't we know? Whatever. What's high impact, what's fading, you know, and these kind of things. What do we do, spending a lot of time on that maybe, you know, we could do differently and that kind of thing. So for me, it just kind of helps to have those little stories of you know, from business or nonprofit or history or NASA or whatever you want to choose, and kind of link that into what we're doing. I think it helps people break away from the, well, we've always done this kind of thing, to like, well, you know, what would Lego do if they were looking at what we were doing? And kind of helps the conversation flow in some different ways.
Brian, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Charlie.
If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas.
Steve will probably cut that out.